one of the special things about the farm workers was the fact that we had a program that demanded, I mean, it didn't develop without church input, but that demanded church support. But we were the articulators of the program. Mm-hmm. I mean, sensitive to, because we had our inside guy who was Chris. Mm-hmm. But we had a program, and so we didn't go to the church like sort of saying, gee, what can you do for us? Mm-hmm. We went saying, we need you to do this for us. And I get the impression that that's a lot of the groups today, Central American movement or whatever, there isn't the same clarity or leadership coming from the movement that requires the support. And so it's difficult for the church to play that kind of supportive role because it's less clear. I mean, that's just from the outside looking at it, but it sure seems to be
it's a really
a
good
problem,
point.
You know?
Because
we were very clear. I mean, we might have demanded hard choices. We might have demanded difficult positions, but we knew what we wanted. And it's a lot tougher with the groups with the very diffuse leadership and diffuse organizational formation. I'm thinking of Central America. So that, because the church's role is, well, I don't want to take your language, but it's more prophecy than kingship. And so if someone else is, it's like, it's a supportive role. It's not a leadership role in the sense that the organization needs to play that leadership role. It needs to articulate, it seems to me. I don't know. It's a big problem on Central America. I don't know what it means on the nuclear thing either. Because I guess the other thing that I see is that a lot of groups don't know how to work with the church. They don't know how to, they don't know what to ask for, how to ask, what to expect. And they have no vision of the potential. I know people I've talked to, I've tried to get them to see what a tremendous thing it was in the farm workers, and they don't have a picture of what that is, you know. So I guess what I'm saying is that the leadership that needs to come from the outside to make the church's contribution meaningful seems to be sort of a problem. But go ahead. I didn't
need No. I'm very interested in that. I hadn't thought about that. Fascinating. That's very interesting. I think you're right.
Because they're distinct roles. Mm-hmm. Now, the Pope tries to make that distinction perhaps in ways that we don't like, mm-hmm. particularly. But there is some validity to it.
Mm.
The church can't play the role that the, you know, that the organization or the political entity or whatever it is supposed to play. Mm-hmm. It's a tension. It's a dynamic tension. I mean, there were prophets and there were kings, and they mm-hmm. had different missions.
Mm-hmm.
And together it can be very creative. But if there's only one part playing its role and the other part doesn't play its role, then it's like trying to dance by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one hand clapping. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you think of that that model you've set up with prophets and kings, I'm not clear which one the union was.
Oh, our role would have been the kingship role. Our role would, well, by that I mean our role would have been political, organizational.
Mm.
And it was our mission to build that and to demand and require and ask for of the church its supportive role. And it seems like the church played a dual role. I mean, it was both helping us do our thing, but it was also sort of, it seems like the power of its role is both its capacity to help, but also the fact that it's a separate, it has a different role, it has a different mission. And so when the church says, this is a good thing, that's very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
If the church were one and the same as what we were, it wouldn't have the same meaning.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's different. So that that means that there has to be, it seems to me, there has to be a constant sort of tension mm-hmm. and criticism.
Do you think that the farm worker ministry was too close?
I wouldn't have said that when I was working for the union. I wouldn't have said that.
How about now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, now I would definitely say it. See, because I think the roles got confused. I think it lost the role of prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mission isn't uncritical obedience. That's not what witness means to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the way to give support all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like sometimes the most supportive thing you can do is do what you're asked. Another time the most supportive thing you can do is ask hard questions.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul Tillich talks about firm love,
mm-hmm.
you know, strong love,
mm-hmm.
and that sometimes it requires a lot of strength to love in a really constructive way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that the ministry has done that in the last few years. I think it's sad. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So it was a very tough place to find, though. I mean, I'm just thinking back to the years that I was in the ministry. I mean, there were clearly times when I thought, as you're expressing now, that we needed to take more of a role of critiquing something that was happening and providing some commentary. But at the same time, there was the problem if that was not heard as helpful, if that was heard as trying to run the show or trying to call the shots or second guessing or whatever, then there was always the possibility that the ministry and its constituencies would lose their sort of confidant place that made it so possible for people to really help.
No, I guess if it were a clear thing, then it wouldn't. How to put it? It's like of course it's not clear. It's difficult to find what that balance is or that line is. I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can't be very clear. I don't think. I mean, that's I guess where the courage comes to decide exactly how to act and what to do. Exactly what posture to take.
Yeah. What kinds of issues do you think the ministry, for instance, as an entity of the church, could have been more helpful on? What would be some examples of that?
I don't know. You know, see, we started going into some very crazy stuff, Pat. I mean, crazy stuff.
You like with sitting on?
Oh, all that. Yeah. And it was I don't quite know how to put this, and I haven't really thought this through this way in relation specifically to the ministry or the church, but it seems like Caesar sort of lost his way at a certain point. And I think it was very hard for us to recognize that, and certainly for all of us to recognize it at the same time and to recognize it in a way that we could deal with it constructively. And it's like, I mean, maybe there could have been a role then, rather than just this, like, just following right down the line, you know? Maybe it would have helped the rest of us. Maybe it would have helped put the thing in some kind of tension or balance or perspective where maybe there would have been more room for the rest of us to deal with it and try to save more of it.
Yeah, it really created more of a middle ground.
That's right. But see, it wasn't that way at all. It's just the opposite. And it was frankly it was disappointing, because what was going on just shouldn't have been going on. And it's like, you know, when you assume, it's like when you clothe yourself in a particular kind of garment, have to sort of be held to that standard. I'm mixing metaphors, but I mean, it's kind of like everybody was very upset about the Israelis at the refugee camps in Lebanon. What happened there? They should have been upset, whoever it was. They were particularly upset because it was the Israelis that seemed implicitly involved.
Excuse me.
And, of course, why? Because the Israelis have put such a high standard to themselves and call the whole world and says, look, we're moral. We demand moral, you know, that you deal with us in a moral way. And so then when something like that happens, everybody's outraged. Well, in the Union, that didn't happen. And it's just no, there was no accountability in that direction. It's unfortunate. It probably would have been very helpful.
What were those years, late 70s, 76 on, I'd say, beginning
with Nick Jones. Nick Jones should never have happened. It was wrong, you know. It was just
the way he was gotten rid of.
Oh, it was just paranoid, you know, witch hunting. And one aspect was the injustice done to Nick in Virginia and so forth. But the even greater damage, and you can't really measure these things because, of course, it shattered their lives, was the damage done to the Union by us acting in that way. We hurt ourselves as much as we hurt them. Or Joe Smith, not a totally innocent guy. Totally, you know. And I mean, that whole sort of period that was ushered in there it was very difficult to deal with. And I don't know. I mean, that's probably a time when more tension would have been more helpful. I think beyond a certain point, it's probably just too late.
What was that period about? Did you understand what was...
You mean 76, 77?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I think that... I think Caesar had a breakdown around 76 or so. I mean, and, you know, we associate that with hollering and screaming. It didn't happen that way a lot of the time. And it doesn't happen as clearly, you know, it doesn't happen as dramatically. But he began going through some real personality changes. I don't know how else to think of it. And I've tried thinking of it a lot over the last few years in different ways and trying to understand what took place. It was very difficult to understand, but it's about the only way I can understand. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can explain and justify and so forth, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that there were some real personality changes taking place. And his personality was so central to the Union, as the leader's personality is in any organization, but particularly one of the nature of the Union, that had all kinds of ramifications. And Prop 14 was a big shock for him. Things that you and I just don't even know, I'm sure, were. But it began to become this kind of inward, fearful, loss of self-confidence, loss of belief in self. It's like something happened to shatter his belief in himself. Because he believed strongly in himself for a long time. He began losing his sense of humor. We saw the Gandhi movie. They did such a wonderful job of showing how he maintained his sense of humor to the end. And that, to me, was indicative of a kind of perspective on yourself. And I also think that's what all that asceticism was all about, was a way to keep yourself in perspective. Like to remember your mortality, your humanity, you know, and not think that you're what the world thinks you are. It's very difficult. I think that's why Gandhi put himself through all that stuff. And he keeps that balance right to the end. Well, it started going out of whack there around 75, 76. It's a lot of self-doubt.
14 must have been a terrible blow, because the union had done everything that it had always done.
Yeah,
did it really well.
It didn't work.
It didn't work.
Yeah.
There was this new factor that the union had never had to really deal with before, of the media.
Yeah, so but we should have just learned from that and gone on. Mm-hmm. I mean, and we would have the time before. Mm-hmm. We never dealt with that failure. We never dealt with that loss. We didn't, in other words, we didn't put it into context ever. We didn't recognize it and say, this is what it means. Mm-hmm. It's like for the one of the very first times we couldn't confront a failure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just deal with it. Mm-hmm. And go on. It's like we had to pretend it didn't happen.
You think that's because it was so big and that Caesar just couldn't,
it,
couldn't
you know,
face it?
It almost seemed to me like it was like one of the things. See, I think Caesar had been going through some stuff in 73 and 4 and 5, and I'm not sure exactly, but one of the things that he certainly always prided himself on was his knowledge of the public. That's like a bedrock thing. Hey, I know the people. Mm-hmm. I know how the public is going to react. Mm-hmm. And he had tremendous insight and sensitivity and judgment about that for a long time. It was tremendous. But it didn't work in Prop 14. I mean, it was something. It was a different ball game. 51% is not 20%. You know, the technology, the money, the whole bit was a different deal. And but it sort of seemed like he interpreted it like a rejection of his, like it was like a, like he blew it, like the people rejected him, the public rejected him, or like his judgment of the public was just off the wall, mm-hmm. or something like that. I know it hurt him a lot, mm-hmm. but I don't think it occurred in total isolation. I think the way that things occur, mm-hmm. and it was a time for the rest of us to be stronger. But we didn't really know what that meant, I don't think, and we were so used to being.
There wasn't really a place. Stronger in some ways.
Oh, well, we could have been on the board. But, I mean, see, we were so used to Caesar being strong for us. And also, there was very little trust among the leadership. Mm-hmm. It was more like to Caesar, but among each other there wasn't mm-hmm. a lot. And, yeah, you're right. I mean, it wasn't that easy. And I don't want to sort of, like, you know, say, gee, we could have done all this stuff. We did what we thought was best. But that period called for a lot more strength from some of the rest of us. And I mean, it's not that the ministry had more of an obligation than the rest of us, but on the other hand, the ministry was distinct from the union and had a different mission than the union. It was very hard for Chris to deal with all that, I'm very sure. I mean, because Chris and I drove up to La Paz the night that we first heard the whole exposition of the Nick Jones conspiracy. Because we went up there to talk with Caesar about how to spend money on media in the Prop 14 campaign, and we wound up in a meeting that went on for several hours about Nick, and then we wound up discussing the spending of $300,000 in 5 minutes or so. See, it wasn't just the obsession with that, but it was like taking away from the other stuff. Or the Synanon, the first encounter with Synanon was, or our first encounter with Synanon was in lieu of a planning meeting about what to do about organizing in the wake of peace with the Teamsters. We never discussed that. What we did was discuss Synanon.
That's very interesting.
It sort of assumed, and see, the freedom of competition with the Teamsters, once the Teamsters were removed, then Caesar didn't have to face the competition of the Teamsters, and it took all the heat off. Mm-hmm. And so the space got filled with this need to get control of things, you know, that he felt were out of control. It's sort of like... See, he ran the union for many years, sort of like more on the metaphors of somebody sailing the ship, you know, where there's wind and sea, and you kind of know kind of how to tack into the wind and do that, or like somebody driving wild horses, you know, sort of guiding the direction. But and then it was like trying to turn it into a little army or something, or a little machine, and it did violence to it. To try to do that, it did violence to the spirit that created it, and so you had a whole radical change in who the personnel of the Union were, and that went on from about 76 and finished around 81. And that process took about 5 years, and it was a virtual 100% shift in personalities among the leadership. And that was a reflection of the changes in Caesar's personality. At least that's how I think of it. But I guess the question for the book is, well, so what about the ministry and all that?
Well, that's one of the questions. I mean, that's certainly a relevant question for now, because the ministry is searching for what its role should be now. It's searching for its role now that there is both the UFW and flock.
Yeah.
And how much energy to put in the different places. And if you're going to put energy into the UFW, how do you do that now? How do you still keep regular church people involved when there isn't a lot for them to do? That's a big issue.
Well, there isn't a lot to do as articulated by the Union, but that's because the Union isn't doing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is Salinas. I mean, this place, you know, there were 7,000 farm workers under contract here in 1981. 7,000 plus under contract here at Salinas, Watsonville, in this area in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
You know, today they're lucky if there's 2,000. Now that's the reality of what's been happening. And I mean, the other reality is that most farm work in California is not organized. I mean, the San Joaquin Valley, the Calexico, the Imperial Valley is all labor contractor territory all over again. I mean, it's just like it's gone back.
Do you know how many members the Union has currently?
Now, I have no idea. I mean, I have a guess, and I know what they claim, and what they claim is fantasy. You know, I mean, it's just not—it's not reality. And so, when you say there's nothing to do, it's a question of like, well, who says there's nothing to do? I mean,
well, it gets back to the first issue, though, that
you raised. That's right. That's exactly
that
right.
It's very hard for the church to be helpful unless there is organization that they could tie in with.
That's right.
Because the church tried to do that on its own.
And didn't work.
All those years. Right. I was part of that. Cecil was in the rural fringe ministry, and oh my God.
No, and it didn't. But what do you think in a situation, I mean, that's right. And the power of the combination when it was working was tremendous. I mean, on both sides, it was a genuinely symbiotic relationship. I mean, it was like, I saw the impact we had on the church. I mean, especially my time in Toronto. I mean, we worked so closely with the Catholics and Protestants and everybody, and it was like, it was tremendous, you know. And I saw what we were doing for the church.
Yes.
I also saw the tremendous positive impact in terms of us. I mean, it provided a language of struggle, a way of, I mean, a mass was a religious sacrament. It was a sacrament of the whole movement. It was like a very... nothing could have filled that vacuum. I mean, it was tremendous, both among farm workers and out on the boycott. It was because it, like I say, it provided a whole context, a language, a way in which to deal with concepts that are hard to deal with. You know, like community and like sacrifice and like all that stuff. And so it was a tremendous value internally to the Union among farm workers. And I don't mean just in support. I mean in terms of the actual impact on the organization, the work, and so forth. But
I was sent to tell you that I'm leaving.
Oh, okay.
I don't expect you at the house.
All right.
Okay.
Bye, Juan.
Is this your child?
Yes.
Bye, Juan Antonio.
We'll see you later.
Goodbye.
Bye. And then I saw the impact it had on the church. I saw the clergy that became involved for the first time, that had to deal with questions they hadn't had to deal with, the congregations that had to deal with stuff, the whole ecumenical aspect of it. I mean, you know, you could just see, oh, gee, this is really a real and exciting thing, because it was changing the church and it was changing the union, and it was a wonderful relationship. It was really dynamic and powerful. But wait, how did we get to this?
We were talking about the problem of the church. What is the church going to do? What's the
now?
Farmworker ministry going to do?
Okay, yeah, that's what I was saying, that the combination was great. But now you've got a situation where the organization that for so many years really was in the forefront of trying to organize farm workers really isn't organizing farm workers anymore. It's dropped the ball. Now, whether there are roles that different people could have played to prevent that from having happened, that's a different question. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not sure that's what I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is today that farm workers in Florida are not being organized by the UFW.
Are there any contracts left?
Well, there might be the Coca-Cola contract. I don't know. That's all that's ever been there since 1971. You can talk to Stephan Robeson. You know, you want to get a sad story. I mean, you know, Stephan now works for Industrial Areas Foundation, and he's the lead organizer at East Brooklyn Churches in New York. Mm-hmm. And, gee, he's just turned into he's a terrific organizer, really good guy. You know, he was in Florida from the time Mac left until he finally left in 81. No, I mean, you know, it was like not allowed to happen. You know? I mean, so the union's not organizing in Florida. It's not organizing in Texas. It's not even organizing in California. And so what does that mean? I mean, presumably the church got involved in the first place because of a ministry to farm workers. Mm-hmm. The union came along as an organization of farm workers with whom the church could work to make that ministry real.
And to really make things change rather than just sort of helping out.
Yeah, of course.
By keeping things the same.
But then what happens when that organization stops doing its thing? What happens if it goes haywire? What happens when it drops the ball? Well, what happens then? Is it to just...
Why do you think the UFW is not organizing workers?
Well, I mean, for me, it goes back to Caesar. Yeah. And I
think he's just tired and worn out?
No, I think... I mean, I really mean what I said before. I think that...
I think there's been a personality change.
I think he had a crisis back in 76 or so. And he began doing things very differently and operating differently and operating very fearfully. And he didn't operate fearfully before. People that were seen as support suddenly became seen as threats. I mean, it's like things changed. And, you know, the spirit, the thing went out of it, you know. I mean, organizing is a creative act. Organizing is an act of creation. It's bringing something into being that wasn't there before. It's an innovative, entrepreneurial sort of activity. I mean, you talk about it in business today, but it's like making something new. It's transforming. If you read James McGregor Burns' book on leadership, it's really, really good. He talks about transformational leadership. But now, if you lose your nerve, if you lose faith in yourself, if you lose belief in yourself, if you replace firmness, decisiveness with stubbornness, if you replace strength with rigidity, you know, all those things that compensate for real weakness, you're not going to organize effectively, because you got to get out there. You got to roll the dice. You got to take chances. That's what it takes to create, to make new things happen, and that's how we operated for years. And that's how we created and made new things happen. And that attracted the kind of people that could do that. You see, but now you change, and you don't want to take any chances. You don't want to risk anything. You don't want to. You're operating out of all this fear. Well, then you can't organize. because organizing is something new. It's bringing something new in. See, it takes people to organize. It takes organizers to organize. Without organizers, you can't organize. Now, I don't care how many direct mail campaigns you do or whatever. It's not how people get organized. They get organized by other people. It's a relation. Organization occurs through relationship, not through communication.
Yeah.
It's not like a mail or a TV. It's people, relating to people.
All the people I've interviewed this week talked about how they were organized.
Yeah.
There was always someone that they knew and trusted who organized it.
And you know what? See, we're attracted by people like us.
Mm-hmm.
See? And so when you have good people, you get more good people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the clone principle. No, but there's really truth to it. And I think if you reflect on it, you see it's true. It's like, when we looked at the boycott back in 72, we were trying to figure out why some cities were disasters, why others weren't, depending on who was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Leadership is a tremendously important factor
mm-hmm.
in organizational development, behavior, and life. Mm-hmm. This is nothing as important, I don't know. And so it takes good people to organize. And because, as you say, so well and brought people in. And so like when you were doing that boycott, it was more than picketing a store. You were investing. This is where the politicians missed the boat completely. That boycott operation in that city was recruiting people who then would be around the union for years and who would be a resource for the union and whose talent and imagination and creativity would be that's the real wealth. You know, that's when the tide goes out, that's what's left behind. You know, it's not like, so the boycott was so powerful because it was, we were picketing the store. But see, what we were doing was creating relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And we had farm workers and organizers, and we were creating relationships with all these people. So after the boycott was over, the relationships remained.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, and that's where we recruited people. And we brought more people. And I mean, that's where people came from.
Mm-hmm.
And so now if you stop organizing, because you don't have people to organize, you cut off what is really the lifeblood of the organization,
mm-hmm.
which is people.
Yes.
It's,
Party's sort of breaking up out there.
Oh.
It's probably about time that you need to go back, too.
Yeah, it is.
We're so, what do you want to do?
Are there as any other really major issues that you'd like to go over, so we could decide how to do that?
I don't know. Are there more things you want to explore?
There's probably no end of things that would be interesting to explore. with both you and Jerry.
Participate.
Yeah.
And that was a tremendous... I mean, that's what gave the boycott the power. It's like, they don't, for some reason, they're not, they don't feel compelled to articulate what they're trying to do in a way that allows people to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like all these different movements and groups, they don't know how.
There aren't similar strong organizations where there is a smaller group that's making centralized decisions about what the strategy is going to be.
It's called leadership. It's called absence of leadership.
Well, there's leadership there, but it's very diverse. Yeah. I mean, it's very diversified, and they're in a lot of... In L.A., I don't know how many Central American organizations we've got. We've got all the refugee organizations, we've got all the solidarity organizations, we've got all the church groups, and they all are sort of deciding different things to do. It just drives me crazy.
Well, one of the tests of leadership is the capacity to unify. I mean, that's exactly the problem. I mean, it's all this diversity and diffusion, and no one can pull it together
mm-hmm.
and then harness it and focus it in a way that is going to produce something, or no one has.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it all gets just scattered all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't... Because when you think about the other things that were going on at the time that we were doing our thing, I mean Vietnam, little things like Vietnam, yet yet people got deeply involved in our thing, which on a cosmic scale was insignificant compared to some of that stuff. It had so much to do with, again, the program and the articulation, the commitment of the people, mm-hmm. you know.
And there was an immediacy because farm workers were coming to our cities and
That's
we were
right.
meeting those farm workers.
That's right.
It brought it all directly home to us. And that's one of the good things on the Central America issue, because at least where we are, I mean, we have these 450,000 refugees in Los Angeles.
No, that's right.
And it provides this immediacy. And one of the things I've been saying ever since 81 is, if we're going to organize on Central America issues, what we've got to do is have ways of keeping having people in the churches meeting these Central Americans. I mean, we've got all of these wonderful
the immediacy's
people.
There, but the definition of the problem to be solved or the act to be done is not there.
Yeah.
It was very, what Marcia said a minute ago, this whole litany of the specifics, you know. When I was in New York last week, I was talking to people that did stuff on the boycott. They still remembered things they did. Mm. See that? I picketed there. At that Christides.
No, that's right.
I picketed there, Jerry. For you schmucks out in California, now what are you doing? You're going to basketball games and you got a llama and, you know that kind of stuff. But I picketed right there.
Yes.
Yeah. You remember it.
Well, see, it's like where they seem to fall is they either tend to be like all these very little tiny specific things mm-hmm. that, or these broad sort of rhetorical cosmic things. It's like there's a level of strategy that's absent.
That's yeah. it. That's
see,
exactly
there's a strategic it. Level. It's all tactical, or it's kind of like these grandiose cosmic mm-hmm. Goals. But it's that middle range. Now, see, that was the genius of the boycott. Mm-hmm. It was a strategic that took specific acts and made them add up to something, yet connected those specific acts to something that was morally significant.
I'll tell you the other thing that's happening in Central America is that we spend almost all of our time in defensive postures.
Well,
we can't seem to get on the offensive. And I don't know. I mean, I never was a strategist. I was always grateful to have someone to respond to. So I don't know what we should do, but I know that's a problem.
But see, we articulated strategy because there was somebody in charge. Mm-hmm. In other words, there were people responsible for doing that. It was like there was a place, you know, mm-hmm. from which. Now, where do you go to find out what the strategy is for Central America, or who decides it?
Comandante Ortega.
Yeah. Well, even if Ortega would decide it for Nicaragua, that would be something.
Yeah.
But is it Blaise Blancpain? I mean, it's.
Yeah, there isn't anyone. There isn't anyone.
And there has to be. I mean, that's, you know, it's like for people's contributions to be meaningful, there has to be a context, a framework
mm-hmm.
within which to integrate so it adds up to something.
Well,
the buck
see,
has
and,
to
and
start somewhere.
Also the rhetoric has got to be pierced.
Oh, that's
and
really
I saw Blaise Blancpain on TV on Sunday morning talking this Marxist drivel.
Yeah, it's really
nothing to do with people. And all it did was, I'm sure, piss off 90% of the people listening.
Yeah.
And it was this drivel.
Yeah.
And that was one thing we also didn't have.
Well,
you know,
see.
We talked earlier about how the fast sort of acted as a cathartic, not deliberate, but, you know, it was like giving the Union a good enema or something. A lot of ideologues took off. Now, you know, I didn't feel bad when Fred Hirsch left, even though he was a good plumber.
But see, that was...
The bullshit didn't translate into action, you know?
But you know, see, that was the significance of a lot of the church involvement, was because you could talk about sacrifice, you could talk about struggle, talk about community in a way that you didn't... I mean, they're using that Marxist language to talk about that stuff. That's not acceptable to the American public.
Mm-hmm.
Religious language is acceptable,
mm-hmm.
and it's much, and that's how we talk about those things here. Mm-hmm. That's another big plus, and that's another place they missed the boat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, this country has a long history of couching social issues in religious terms,
mm-hmm.
abolitionism, you know, and so forth, civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been in the language, or very often been in the language of religion. And so that was something the farm workers were like in that tradition too.
Yeah.
But then some guy walks along and talks about, you know, dictatorship of the proletariat or something like that. I mean, it's like...
It rings all of the bells.
Oh, God, you know, it's just... yeah. But that's a real frustrating thing, that Central America deal.
Yeah. There may be other models for organizing for change that it just that for some of us it's hard to identify another really workable model for that kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard.
Well, the Nicaraguans ought to be articulating what people should do.
Strategy,
up there.
Yes.
But it's like they've got their thing, they don't have a sense of what's here. It's like, who knows who gives them advice, mm-hmm. but I mean, it's like, I'm afraid to know.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And then, I mean, the El Salvador deal, I mean, that's, now there's, I mean, there you got these groups of guerrillas up there in the mountains, and like, are they going to dictate the boycott strategy? I mean,
well, you know what some of the Central American refugees here are saying when some of us have raised this very issue with them, that what we need is to have some of you Central Americans deciding on strategy. And they say to us, they say, but we can't decide on strategy. I mean, your government's policy is your problem.
Yeah.
You need to decide on the strategy.
Well,
you need to solve
that's
that.
A cop-out. See, that's a real cop-out. It's a total cop-out. Look, the most effective models for this sort of thing that I know of are Gandhi and his struggle to free India and in South Africa, the civil rights movement in relation to the North and the South, and the farm workers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in all three cases, you had people who were leading the struggle who were conscious that the struggle was going to be won at two fronts, not one. That there was a front right there where the people were, and there was a second front where the power was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the power to resolve Gandhi's problem was partly in India and it was also in England.
Mm-hmm.
The problem to solve our problem was partly in Delano, but it was very much in New York, Boston, and Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
The power to solve the civil rights movement was in Mississippi, but it was also in New York, Boston, Los Angeles. And so the leadership of each of those movements, you were watching both fronts. You knew you had to orchestrate your struggle in the awareness that you had both of those fronts, both of those arenas. And so Gandhi, and then the trick was to come up with things that were meaningful in both. Something like the fast in 68 was meaningful to farm workers, and in that whole setting it built our power and all that, and it interpreted our movement to the cities and all that kind of stuff too. So it's a double whammy. And see, nonviolence particularly falls into that. It has that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Central America, part of the power is in Central America, but a whole lot of the power is right here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, but they need to recognize that they've got to win in this front here in order to win. Otherwise they don't win. No more than Allende won. I mean, it's two fronts to the war. And I mean, you know, it's a
tough problem.
It's a tough problem. It's a
just
very
like
tough
everything
problem.
Else.
Like they can't win it there.
Yeah.
And it's not enough for them to say, well, now you figure it out. See? I mean, so Caesar say, there's grapes in the city. You figure out what to do about it. But see, I wonder who's confronting. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's very presumptuous to say, you know, here's these people, you know, they've got their lives on the line, everything down there.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, who's putting them in the North American context of what the realities of this country are? I really wonder about that. And that seems to me to be a role the church could play. Because if they're, the thing I always felt about the FMLN, FMLN and the FDR and all this, was that they made their connections were with their ideological brethren here.
Mm-hmm.
Who, it's like, to be a Marxist in Nicaragua or El Salvador is a very reasonable thing to be.
Mm-hmm.
To be a Trotskyist or some sort of Marxist in the American setting is a very different thing to be. Now you have
doesn't have a whole lot of power behind it either.
Well, and it's very different kinds of personalities. I mean, see,
mm-hmm.
you can see young people, very, you know, good leadership, young people with real compassion, you know, people together
mm-hmm.
becoming Marxists in Nicaragua. You can certainly see that. Now, for people to get into Marxism over here is a real different kind of personality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just different politics, it's different kind of people.
Yeah.
So you have people who are genuine leaders over there dealing with the CISPAS over here.
Mm-hmm.
That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
It's like it doesn't match. You
mm-hmm.
know?
Well, so they, from their point of view, they take what they can get, too.
Well, of course.
Because they're under so much pressure over there, they don't have time to sit down and figure it out.
You know?
Yeah, that's true.
The problem is if they don't figure it out, they're never going to solve the problem. I mean, and you know, it's just every 10 years we go down there and turn over some government. I mean, Otto Benson, Guatemala, we tried it with Castro, we did it with Allende. It's a decade, you know, we seem to...
We need to do that.
Yeah, we need to do it to keep them in line, you know, and so now it's Nicaragua's turn.
Do you think the American people will ever learn about that? I mean, do you think they'll ever really learn